Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Is your underwear in need of a refresh? Meet Tomboy X, makers of the original boxer briefs for women, queer founded and queer run. Tomboy X designs sustainable, gender inclusive underwear and apparel in sizes 3XS to 6XL. Use code IHEART at checkout for 20% off your first purchase only at tomboyx.com. Shop now on tomboyx.com.
Hi everyone, it's just me today, James, again, and I'm talking today with my friend Billy Ford. Billy's a program officer for the Burma team at the United States Institute of Peace. And do you want to say hello, Billy?
Hey, James. Hey to your audience. Thanks for tuning in.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. Was that a decent introduction? Have I summed up
that sounds right.
What you do?
Yeah.
Good. Didn't want to get that wrong. Right, so people will have heard Billy before or heard from Billy when we finished our last series on Myanmar, where we spoke about the funding that the PDFs are using and how they're using a lot of unique and really innovative methods to continue to support their revolution when they're not getting very much at all in the way of international support, and certainly like nothing compared to countries like Ukraine. But what we wanted to talk a little bit about today was the SAC, or the junta's attempts at kind of staging a sham election, which they've sort of backed off on. Can you explain a little bit about what they had proposed and then what they're doing now?
Right. Yeah. So the expectation was, upon instigating the coup February 1st, 2021, that the state of emergency would end on February 1st, 2023, which was 2 days ago, giving them 6 months after that that period to kind of undertake an election. And so the expectation was that before August 1st, 2023, there would be this sort of sham electoral process, and the junta would essentially structure the process in such a way that their political party, the USDP, would prevail, and that the commander-in-chief, Min Aung Hlaing, who runs the SAC junta, would ascend as he had dreamed to become the president of the country and kind of rule in a military dictatorship model, but under kind of these auspices of civilian governance. So that was the expectation, but things have changed, as you kind of alluded to.
Yeah, so they've said they're going to extend for another 6 months. Is that right?
That's right. So they said they would extend for another 6 months until August 1st. But then this morning, they also announced a new political, economic, and social objectives, which includes a 5-point roadmap, which, for those of you who've been following Myanmar for some time, is often the way that they frame their kind of sham and circuitous approaches to civilian governance. That articulates a series of reforms, restoring law and order, you know, social development, implementing a peace process, and then holding elections. And this is I think, indicates to most people that elections are very unlikely to occur anytime in the near future. They did something almost identical in 2004, articulating a roadmap to democracy, and that didn't really start until 2010, when there were elections, and there weren't really meaningful ones until 2015. But this is kind of an indication to, I think, a lot of folks that elections are unlikely this year and that there's kind of a long road ahead. The interesting element of this will be to see how the junta's kind of enablers in the international community, including Thailand, China, and India in particular, how they will respond, in part because they were pushing the SAC very hard to undertake these elections as a potential off-ramp to the horrifying violence that is that resulted from the coup and all the atrocities that the SAC has committed.
Maybe we could talk a little bit about the international support they have, because it's still quite significant, and like especially in terms of propping up their military force through the use of air power. They don't have domestic like fighter jet manufacturing, right? So can you talk a little bit about that? Like, I think they received a couple more planes very recently, right?
Yeah, from the Chinese. It's kind of an interesting dynamic whereby you have an entire country of 53-ish million people fighting against a tiny military institution of about 500,000 or fewer, if you include their families and all the medics. And that tiny institution is being supported by just a handful of countries. As I said, kind of China, Russia, to a certain degree, India and Thailand, and a few others. And the vast majority of the world is kind of opposes this military takeover and the subsequent dictatorship and all the horrendous atrocities that they've committed. And so there's quite a lot of international actors who are providing kind of rhetorical support to the resistance and some, support to civil society and humanitarian assistance and others. But, on balance, the support that the Chinese, Indians, Russians in particular have provided in terms of material assistance to the SAC, as well as the diplomatic assistance that the Chinese provide at the Security Council in particular, but also the Thais provide within ASEAN, is, it far outweighs the rhetorical and small material assistance that the West and, other supporters of the resistance movement have provided. So yes, to answer your question, the Chinese and Indians continue to provide material military assistance to the SAC. My question is kind of, what is their theory of change here, and how will supporting the SAC militarily lead to anything like stabilization? It's just kind of perplexing to me when both countries are very interested in supporting a level of functional stability so they can undertake their economic and geopolitical objectives, many of which go through Myanmar. I just don't really understand how they see kind of a military victory by the SAC as a pathway to stabilization when you have an entire nation that has risen up against this dictatorship and has wholly rejected it and demonstrated that they're willing to make these incredible sacrifices to ensure that this coup does not succeed.
Yeah, it's very perplexing, because like it's not in any sort of conventional sense like a consolidated regime, and nor does it show any chance of being one, right? Like it doesn't even have territorial control over large swathes of the country that it claims.
Yeah, exactly. And you're even hearing this. I mean, there's been quite a bit of research, contested research, that shows the junta has less than 50% control. But even today, day before yesterday, you heard from Min Online, the junta leader, that he's now admitting that they only have 60% control, which is a pretty sanguine analysis of what they control. It's probably much smaller than that. But, them demonstrating that they do not have control over 40% of the country is a pretty staggering proposition and kind of indication to their allies that, they just don't have the capacity to administer a country that's unwilling to be pacified. And on top of that, there's very little, I just don't see a pathway in which they will capture more territory. They have, right. Constrained resources. They have, I think they had 22 entrants into the Defense Service Academy last year. I mean, they're just, when there's casualties really? On the front lines, yeah. There's not a lot of replacement happening. They're not able to get spare parts for their Russian-made helicopters. There's just major material constraints that the SAC's military is facing, and it's just hard to imagine that they will ever regain much more than, what they say is 60% territorial control.
Yeah, it's very, and then if we look at the PDFs by comparison, I got banned from Twitter last week for posting a picture of them, but their equipment compared to even a year ago is vastly improved. I don't know if you saw the one group of guys with the Accra International rifle, but I have no idea where that came from. But it's very impressive that they have one.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of, honestly, the resilience of this movement is partly a testament to the ingenuity and innovation. We saw it in the beginning, in the nonviolent action demonstrating mm-hmm. or kind of deploying tactics that we've never seen before that have, been lessons to other international nonviolent movements around the world, just really creative fundraising tactics, as you and I have discussed in the past. But yeah, now it's the military ingenuity. I mean, essentially creating facilities for retrofitting drones for aerial attacks. One of the military's helicopters was taken down this morning. I don't know exactly what weapons were used in that, but it's just kind of a level of innovation, given that these, the PDFs and most of the Aeros have very little access to very few international arms markets. So the fact that they're able to sustain themselves at all and maintain this, 40%, which is probably much more, of the territory is kind of an incredible testament to their innovation and ingenuity.
Yeah, there's a couple, obviously, of several PDF fighters who I keep in touch with, and they've spoken to me about, first they 3D printed guns, which we've mm-hmm. spoken about extensively, but also tourniquets, night vision goggles, even prostheses, like limbs, people who have lost legs, right, to landmines and things. So it's amazing that they've set up all these things which normally require a massive interaction with the state and with an international system, and they've done it using, in this case, the internet and a $300 printer they got on AliExpress or something.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Yeah, it's extremely sort of inspirational in that sense, but also very sad. I want to talk a little bit about the SAC seems to have, it's not fair to say they've pivoted to war crimes, because it's been kind of integral to what they've done from the outset, but they seem to have given up on trying to make targeted strikes against military formations and just pivoted to dropping bombs on civilians. Mm-hmm. Could you talk about a couple of those? Maybe we could talk about the Kachin mm-hmm. Music cultural festival that they bombed, or one of the other examples of that.
Yeah, there's definitely been a shift from a strategy of essentially augmenting or providing air support to kind of exposed frontline light infantry to a tactic of targeted airstrikes against civilian targets and against armed organization headquarters, which had under previous negotiations been deemed off limits. But it seems as if there is nothing off limits now. They bombed the Chin National Front's headquarters, which is right on the India-Chin border on the western part of Myanmar. And there's pretty reliable accounts that there were bombs that landed in Indian territory. As you referenced, there was a bombing in Kachin State on a festival, killing at least 60 civilians. They've done something similar on ethnic armed organization headquarters in the southeast in Karen territories, including the Arakan Army's facilities in those areas. So there has been a shift in tactic to targeting headquarters facilities in that sense. And as you said, kind of civilian targets to, I don't know, you know, this is just the modus operandi of an institution that is devoid of humanity and so alienated from society that they, you know, they're willing to go to any ends to kind of protect themselves and their control of power. I think particularly now that they've seen that the public is against them and probably quite concerned that if they are unsuccessful in this military endeavor, that they'll be kind of strung up, you know? So it's, I think it's kind of a sign of desperation and, as you mentioned, kind of a tactical shift.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Health Aid kombucha.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Maybe we should explain the sort of four-cut strategy, which has been a long-term strategy even before the coup of the military, and what that means and how that sort of provides, I guess, I don't know, like a moral framework. Maybe that's the wrong way. But, you know, this it's not like they started doing this shit in February 1st, 2021, right? Like, this is how they do stuff.
Yeah. I mean, this is an institution that's been at war with its own people for 70 years. I mean, there is an underlying philosophy of the Myanmar military, the Sitat, that they essentially are the protectors of national sovereignty and to a certain degree are protectors of the Bamar ethnic group and Bamar Buddhism in particular. And this is a deeply entrenched philosophy within the military establishment, and it's been to a certain degree a fairly compelling narrative for retention and institutional solidarity, which is why in some part, I mean, it's one of the reasons, there are a number why this, the SAC and the SITDAT, Myanmar military, has been resilient to collapse despite, you know, being extremely incompetent and very isolated, and virtually never having won a war despite being at war for 70 years and having structural and military advantages. And so this is kind of underlying the justification and the moral philosophy of this institution that is morally corrupted. But as you said, their tactical strategy is essentially one of social isolation, division, and ensuring as much human suffering as possible so as to pacify a population into submission. And so essentially the strategy is to kind of cut communications and food supply and connections between communities and these sorts of things, which is for a very long time, the military strategy has been one of divide and conquer, in which they've attempted to exacerbate divisions between ethnic and religious minority communities to ensure that they would not face a united front. And so the incredible challenge and opportunity of the current resistance movement is one in which the Myanmar military is no longer at the table in conversations with one another, and they are trying to build cohesion with one another. And frankly, this is where there is unbelievable progress that I don't think gets enough attention and appreciation, that there's meaningful changes in behavior in terms of the Bamar majority ethnic communities' posture towards ethnic and religious minorities, and, you know, communication and coordination across institutions that had historically been at odds. And happy to go more into that. But yeah, this strategy of divide and conquer is really front and center.
Yeah, and ironically, by pushing that so hard that they've done the complete opposite, which is forced people to form like a popular front against them. Yeah, let's talk about that, because I find it really fascinating how, like, even how like EAOs and PDFs are kind of vaguely underneath a unified command at this point. So yeah, let's talk about how those barriers, which existed for so long, are sort of gradually breaking down now.
Yeah,
rapidly, I guess.
One of the ways in which there's been a meaningful shift has been just kind of the individual experiences of the military's atrocities. I mean, I think in your previous episode with Ko-on Chomo, he had indicated that public perception of Rohingya has shifted somewhat, although it's kind of questionable whether it's a durable shift and whether it's meaningful and all that. But he had attributed that shift in part to the fact that the Bamar majority Buddhist population is now experiencing, frankly, some of the forms of atrocity that the Rohingya had experienced, you know, in the 70s and the 90s, and then in 2016-17 when things escalated to genocide. So I think this is one of the shifts, is that in the Burmese heartland, in the area where the military recruits most of its soldiers, they are undertaking arguably the most extreme atrocities, burning villages to the ground, you know, just horrendous stuff that, like, I don't even want to say on the air, but just, you know, just an incredible campaign of terror, in part because the People's Defense Forces and the resistance forces are extremely strong there and only strengthening in response to these atrocities. So I think that's one of the dynamics, is that there's been a shift in perception because of the junta's behavior. Another is that, frankly, there's just a massive political shift at play. I mean, you have, you know, February 1st, the National League for Democracy-led government is deposed, and they don't necessarily have arms or an experience of military combat, whereas the ethnic armed organizations have been fighting for 70 years against the central government, including the National League for Democracy-led government. And so there is a shift in power at that moment, that, you know, shifts power from the Bamar center to ethnic minority communities in a particular way. So that kind of opened space for greater humility and greater dialogue and, you know, willingness to make concessions to ethnic and religious minority communities. And that is, there's actually been tremendous progress there. So there's the National Unity Consultative Council, which is, you know, probably the most important dialogue platform, but one that is very focused on big picture governance challenges and long-term kind of national dialogue processes. But there's been some good progress there, but frankly, the most progress has been made in military and governance coordination platforms. So this includes the C3C, which is essentially a command and control platform that's between the National Unity Government and ethnic armed organization leadership, where they're coordinating military strategy and tactics. So there's been considerable trust building through those sorts of operations. And similarly, there's been trust building in, you know, basic things like coordinating humanitarian assistance or local administration or policing, these sorts of things, where there's you know, there's a problem that needs to be solved in the near term, and we can come together to solve it collaboratively, and in that process sort of build understanding and trust with one another. So there's been really meaningful differences I've seen in terms of cohesion across traditional lines of intercommunal division. Obviously a long way to go, but this is a lot of what we're working on at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and that the U.S. government is supporting, is trying to support the resistance capacity to chart a viable pathway to stabilization. And a lot of that relies upon building cohesion and trust among resistance groups.
Yeah. Everyone I spoke to, not everyone I spoke to was Bamar. Some people were Karen. And some of them were, some of the people we'd spoken to, like remotely, were Rohingya. All of them said that what has to come out of this is like a federalized democracy. Do you think that that's likely? And what does that look like in a country that's been at war with itself for most of this last century?
Yeah, I mean, clearly this is a question that needs to be answered by the Myanmar people. Yeah. And I think the National Unity Consultative Council is a good platform for having this discussion. But there is a number of prerequisites for having that discussion. And one of them is kind of new norms of dialogue based on trust and mutual respect. But yeah, I think that the only viable pathway to stability is, you know, is one that results in a federal democratic system in which subnational federal units have a degree of autonomy, and in which there is a baseline of equality. There is rule of law, independent judiciary, you know, just the basic fundamentals that ensure protections of minority populations. You know, another challenge being that even, you know, within states like Kachin State, where, you know, the Kachin ethnic community is a ethnic minority at the national level, but there are also sub minorities that, you know, like the Shawnee population. Yeah. And there's concerns that, you know, there needs to be protections for the minorities within the minority state. So, you know, all of these things need to be sort of worked out. And this is, of course, like maybe a decade-long national dialogue process that will ultimately culminate in a new federal governance structure, a new security structure that, you know, maybe doesn't have a federal, you know, a union-level military with the level of autonomy or political involvement that, you know, has plagued this country for so long. But this is really like the key to long-term peace and stability in the country. And frankly, like, it felt a long way off under the NLD administration. I mean, they were making a lot of progress in a lot of ways, but, you know, building a just and an equitable governance structure in which ethnic and religious minorities had a voice and didn't feel oppressed by the dominant Bamar Buddhist population. Frankly, it was quite a ways off. And this, you know, as horrible as the coup has been, it is definitely a shock to the system that may open up new pathways for dialogue, new opportunities for trust building, and, you know, the opportunity to, you know, think about a new model of governance that is, you know, more just, more equitable, more inclusive.
Yeah, it's definitely brought in a whole generation of younger people who, like, aren't sort of, who didn't come through the institutions that created the old regime and just came at this as like, I'm 17 and I'm fucking angry. Yeah. And like, I'm gonna make this better sort of however I can. And yeah, they're really, I mean, obviously very inspirational and fascinated to talk to. I wonder, like, how do you see the end to this conflict? Because we're still a long way from like either side having a definitive military victory, right? Certainly all these big cities are still more or less controlled by the junta, and there's not an immediate way that I can foresee them not being that way. So if I could ask you to like speculate a little bit or look at the way things are going, how do we get out of the situation where the junta's bombing schools and music concerts? And
right. This is honestly, like, I think everyone is kind of lost in our attempts to make predictions of where this is going. Honestly, I don't know that there is a path to a military victory for either side here. I mean, it seems pretty unlikely that you'll see PDFs marching on Naypyidaw and capturing the Ministry of Defense anytime soon. but equally unlikely that the SAC will consolidate, you know, control of the country. I mean, that's just not going to happen. A lot of our work is thinking through the best possible outcomes and increasing the doing the work to try to increase the probability of those outcomes. And I think this is where it's just like, I have questions for a lot of the international actors that are supporting the SAC, because I just don't know of any possible pathway to peace and stabilization that goes through a stronger SAC. It just seems unfathomable. There are pathways to stabilization that go through a stronger resistance movement that either yields some radical transformation of the SAC's composition and then some sort of dialogue process, just a very, very extended conflict in which, you know, the resistance holds territory in some parts of the country, the SAC controls some other areas over an extended period, the ethnic armed organizations act more and more autonomously, and you have areas in, you know, Kachin and Wak, Kokong on the Chinese border, Rakhine State, that just kind of gain a bit more autonomy and sort of act more independently of one another. So like this sort of fragmentation process. And honestly, if there is an election, you know, a sham election by the SAC, it seems to increase the probability of this fragmentation scenario. It increases the probability that the SAC just maintains its presence in the urban areas, and then Rakhine State, Kachin State, Wa State, these kind of become more autonomous regions, Chin State, and they start to operate as semi-independent states. So honestly, that's part of why I feel like support to the SAC, not only is it SAC for the elections, I should say, not only does it almost definitely increase violence because, you know, the elections are a target, but also it increases the probability of national fragmentation. And it doesn't do anything to increase the probability of stability. So I just don't really see that being a pathway to any form of stability or ending the SAC's bombings of schools.
Yeah, I think it gives them this weird talking point, but like the Russian sham elections in the Donbass, because we saw, like, I think it was a Mobye PDF. I don't know if you saw this, but they did a drive-by and shot some people who were polling for doing some kind of election stuff. And obviously that gives them this kind of, oh, look, our election workers are being attacked. What terrible people the PDFs are, kind of. But, if you've spent more than 10 minutes your entire life reading about Myanmar, then you'll realize that's a false claim.
Mm-hmm. Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having pink lady apple, berry lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feelin' Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
The international community just doesn't seem to care to a large degree about atrocities in Myanmar, about the revolution in Myanmar, about the coup in Myanmar. Certainly doesn't care in the same way that it cares about what's happening in Ukraine, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't care with man pads and tanks and guns and training and all the things that could bring this war to an end much more quickly. Do you think that that will change, or is this going to be Burmese people liberating Burmese people because the world doesn't care about them,
mm-hmm.
or doesn't care in a material fashion?
Yeah, I think there's like
concerned.
Yeah, I think there's sort of like two dynamics at play here. One is that, yeah, people care a lot less than Ukraine or Taiwan or other geopolitical interests. They see this to a certain level as a domestic issue that doesn't have regional implications, something that we're very focused on demonstrating is totally untrue. And the other thing is that people don't know what to do. And like, I mean, even the U.S. Congress just passed the Burma Act, which is a piece of legislation that essentially signals congressional interest in Burma and more to be done alongside appropriations of resources to support it. The challenge now is figuring out what is the best use of resources. And I think that countries like Japan and honestly some EU states, you know, ASEAN states, it's more they are very uncomfortable with the engaging with revolutionary actors. And there's just not a lot of certainty as to how to help, because there's like, okay, military assistance to the NUG, it's like there's a lot of concern that, you know, significant expansion of arms access in the country is, you know, you have this mass proliferation of weapons, you have, you know, concerns about post-conflict warlordism or weapons and resources getting into the hands of narco traffickers. You know, there's just a lot of uncertainty. And so there's not an adequate, given what the first point that this is a kind of peripheral regional matter in the eyes of some, it yields a very low risk tolerance and uncertainty as to what to do. And so this kind of has resulted in a couple of things. One being that the buck is just passed to multilateral institutions like ASEAN. I mean, I think China has done a very effective job of ensuring nothing happens in the international realm. By pushing it to ASEAN, which it knows is incapable of doing anything meaningful. And so it's just relegated to multilateral platforms where nothing will happen. You always have a veto from Thailand, Cambodia, or Russia and China at the Security Council. And so, you know, it's these combinations of factors that really challenge this thing. And even within the U.S. government, there's like a very robust interagency debate about exactly what is the best form of assistance? What is the most ethical way of engaging? And what are risks associated with different forms of assistance to the resistance movement? So I think that uncertainty plays a lot into it. And so a lot of what I think there's a lot of value that could be added if the resistance movement can come together essentially around a common set of requests from the international community, essentially saying, this is what we need to be effective. And, you know, you, based on your risk tolerance, help us as you can. But we're demonstrating to you that we're unified in these ways. We have these needs and, you know, help us however you feel is most appropriate given your risk tolerance. So I don't know. It's incredibly complicated. I think the having China, India, Bangladesh, Thailand, and Laos as your neighbors also makes this just incredibly challenging. You can't access the country in the way that you can for Ukraine. So just logistically, it's incredibly challenging.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it does seem still, like you said, like it like in Ukraine, we also have deeply problematic groups who we are arming. Yeah, it's ironic that their concern is spreading the preventing the proliferation in arms, when what they've done is helped like a giant leap forward in I don't know, artisanal homemade weapons technology that like we're probably only seeing the very tip of in like our reporting. Like I'm sure there's more stuff that we'll see as time goes on. Billy, I wonder what can people do? People often ask like if where they can donate, how they can help, right? Because obviously it is extremely difficult to see little kids getting shot in schools and want to do something. And I wonder what you would suggest for people who are looking to help. Mm-hmm. Like we've both spoken to people who are collecting money through Click to Donate, which is one thing people can do. But did you want to explain that? Actually explain how people can participate in Click to Donate, because I think that's cool.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a number of really fascinating fundraising models. The Click to Donate model is essentially the resistance leveraging what it has a comparative advantage in, which is huge numbers of people on their side. And essentially, the resistance creates web pages or YouTube content or anything and, you know, just engages the advertisements on those pages, which increases the value of that ad space, and then they can kind of generate revenue that way. The National Unity Government has also done some really fascinating stuff, issuing bonds, conducting a lottery, selling off, you know, SAC military properties. Yeah. I think they just sold Min Aung Hlaing's house in Yangon for a considerable amount. So it's kind of an incredible fundraising model and requiring tremendous innovation. They've also created a financial technology called NUGPay and a digital currency, DMMK. It's kind of a remarkable innovation there. In terms of what kind of your listeners could do, I think, I think engaging in some of the international kind of advocacy and awareness raising is really valuable. I think some of these things, like if your congressperson acknowledges demand for this, then that can increase the pressure that they put on the State Department, DOD, National Security Council, and potentially increase the risk tolerance of the U.S. government if there's just more pressure there. So those sorts of things, I think, honestly, engaging with some of the content that's being created by the resistance, learning about Myanmar, just following the story. I mean, it's like, I don't know, you've probably experienced this doing your reporting, but it's just like the most unbelievable stories of human resilience, and just like, I don't know, it's such like an honor to be nearby these people who are just risking so much for such an honorable cause that they truly believe in. It's just like the quintessential example of integrity and human goodness.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's stuff you couldn't make up, and like it's stories you couldn't sell as fiction almost. Like their integrity, like even their like one thing I find absolutely amazing is, like you said, perspectives on ethnic groups have changed on so many things that people, their willingness to be like, I've examined my stance on this and it was the wrong stance and I'm changing my stance on this. It's like we spoke to so many young people who were like, yeah, I was fairly misogynist, February 1st, 2021. And since then, like I've fought alongside women. I've seen them do things that I'd been told that they weren't capable of, and I've changed. I was wrong. And we need to not be a misogynist country going forward.
Yeah. No, there's like, this group, but I was engaging with armed organization that's led by kind of an activist, former activist. And he was kind of saying that they've essentially tried to eliminate all of the sort of misogyny in their training protocols, like even just using terms like man up or something, it's like wiped it from their approach. Cause it's like, that's a misogynistic kind of, approach to thinking about strength and power. And so it's like, what you're saying is I'm feeling the same, hearing the same things, which is incredibly powerful, particularly given the pressures and what they're all going through, just having the wherewithal to kind of pick their head up and think about, you know, be reflective of themselves. Like, imagine in the American political discourse, people actually changing their minds for once. It's remarkable.
Yeah. No, it genuinely is. And it's refreshing in that sense to see people like wanting the right thing and not letting tiny differences like blow them into 7,000 different pieces, right? Like broadly agreeing on one thing.
Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of the remarkable. I mean, the National Unity Consultative Council, for example, you know, it's had its challenges as a dialogue platform, but it's still going. And that is like people are still coming to the table. And frankly, it's remarkable because repeatedly in quote unquote peace processes in Myanmar's history, they've collapsed because, you know, someone said something and, you know, another party left the table and didn't return. So the fact that these dialogues are continuing on is an incredible testament to people's willingness to kind of open up and be more humble and kind of consider the other's opinion and question their own, which is, you know, a lesson we could all learn.
Yeah, definitely. Billy, where can people find you online and where can they find more good information about Myanmar?
I am, you know, if you search Billy Ford at usip.org, you can find the stuff I've written recently. And then I'm on Twitter at BILLEE, the number 4, the letter D. And good sources of information. I mean, there's great investigative work by Myanmar Witness, which is just an incredible group of researchers. There's been a couple of good reports recently by Global Witness and Earth Rights related to sanctions that just came out. USIP, you can check out some of our writing. My colleagues Jason Tower and Priscilla Clapp just published something related to how the conflict has regional consequences that could be of interest. There's innumerable great Myanmar think tanks. The Chin Human Rights Organization has done some incredible research and reporting about military atrocities in Chin State. Could go on and on, but check out my Twitter. I tend to repost stuff that I find fascinating, and there's a lot out there.
Yeah, great. Well, thank you so much for giving us some of your time this afternoon. I really appreciate it. It's good to catch up.
Yeah, thanks for having me, James. It's been great.
No worries.
It Could Happen Here is a production of Cool Zone Media. For more podcasts from Cool Zone Media, visit our website, coolzonemedia.com, or check us out on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can find sources for It Could Happen Here updated monthly at coolzonemedia.com/sources. Thanks for listening.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Health Aid kombucha.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
There's nothing worse than wearing clothes that don't fit right. That's why Tomboy X makes size and gender-inclusive underwear, swimwear, and loungewear for all bodies. Queer-founded and run for over 10 years, you can trust they know a thing or two about making the perfect pair. Feel comfortable in your own skin. Shop online today and use code IHEART for 20% off your first purchase. Only at TomboyX.com. Tomboy X. Fit for you just as you are.